This is the way the world will end. I think they said it three times at the beginning of The Stand with this music in the background. Wonder how many of you remember that. What an incredible movie that was, The Stand. I just had an opportunity recently to watch it all over again, and it was every bit as good. This is the way the world will end. It may well. Jennifer Ouellette is a recovering English major who stumbled into science by writing, that is, quite by accident, as a struggling freelance writer in New York City. She is the author of Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, Tales from the Annals of Physics and the Physics of the Buffyverse. She is associate editor of APS News, the monthly publication of the American Physical Society, writes for the American Institute of Physics TV project, Discoveries and Breakthroughs in Science, as well as its Inside Science News Service. Jennifer is equally adept at writing about science in the popular press, most noticeably for Discover, Salon, and New Scientist. Wow. She has written about such varied topics as the acoustics of Mayan pyramids and New York City's subways, fractal patterns in the paintings of Jackson Pollock, the science behind architectural arches, and the precarious pitfalls of pseudoscience. A strong advocate of public outreach and education in the sciences and critical thinking in general, Jennifer presides over the popular science blog Cocktail Party Physics. Coming up in a moment, Jennifer Ouellette. You know, I would say in the sciences, probably by a ratio of about 9 out of 10, it's men, not women. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It really is about that ratio, Jennifer.
Yes, I know, particularly in the hard sciences.
Why?
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of different reasons. A lot of it is, I think, cultural. A lot of it is the fact that, basically it's been a male-dominated field for a very long time. Certain ways, you know, certain traditions and things are in place there that kind of, you know, favor a male culture. Women bring something different, I think, to the table.
Our entire society bends it that way. Girls play with dolls, boys play with...
Yeah.
So I wonder why that is. Does that really need to completely change for us to get as many women in science as men?
No, I don't think so. I think that, women might approach the subject differently. They might think in a different way, but that doesn't mean they can't bring something valuable to it without sacrificing specifically what makes them, you know, uniquely female.
Oh, I completely agree. Completely agree. I just finished reading, and we were talking in the first hour about quantum computers. There's an announcement of a company in British Columbia.
Yes.
That is releasing a quantum computer, albeit a very early one, but it's an actual quantum computer.
Right, 16 qubits, apparently.
That's it. Now, that marks sort of a demarcation line or something, doesn't it? It's the beginning of something very new?
I think so. I've kind of been poking around the physics blogs trying to find out a little bit more about the announcement. I think a lot of people are waiting to actually witness the demonstration and see how well it works. If there's been a little bit, I think, of hype in terms of it, but I mean, it's certainly a very, very important first step. I mean, 16 qubits is, you know, of a working quantum computer is a very, very big advance.
One has to wonder, when we get fully into the quantum computer world, if we are able to, and I guess we're going to, what it's going to mean. If you had a very, very, very powerful quantum computer, there are all kinds of things to wonder about. For example, might it be possible for a quantum computer to retrieve answers and information from, for example, another dimension?
That I couldn't answer. That is intriguing. I don't think that's anywhere near the focus of what they're doing. They're just trying to basically solve very difficult math problems, what's known as NP problems.
Right.
That's interesting in and of itself because, from what I understand, those sorts of problems are used in security, computer security systems. So if it became suddenly very, very easy to hack those problems, I mean, we might have a whole new issue of computer security ahead of us.
In other words, what we consider to be unbreakable security right now would just completely break down.
I would think so, yes.
Oh, boy. All right.
I don't think Orion will be able to do that. It's still a very rudimentary prototype, but it's certainly an important announcement, and I know a lot of people are looking to it for with a great deal of anticipation.
Mm-hmm. You write about very interesting things, and the first question is relevant. There is physics, I guess, in shows like Star Trek, but Buffy the Vampire Slayer and things like that, monsters, magic, how do you get there? And
yeah,
where do you
I know.
Get physics?
I get a lot of skepticism, particularly from scientists, when they first hear the title of the book. But my argument basically is we're dealing with an actual universe. It's a fictional universe. But any time when you're creating a fictional world, particularly in science fiction, that universe has to have rules. And the Buffyverse is no different from Star Trek or any other science fiction universe in that it does set up a certain amount of rules and physical laws. And while they can be bent and sometimes broken for purposes of the plot, in general, they do try and follow those rules. And so I just kind of use that to say, well, how does the Buffyverse work, and what are some of the analogies that we can draw to our own world? What are the differences? What are the similarities? And why are those differences there?
Is it likely that there are other universes?
That's a really intriguing question that a lot of different physicists are working on. Certainly, there is a lot of talk about a multiverse. Stephen Hawking has talked about it. I mean, basically, the thinking goes that if our universe started as kind of a random fluctuation in the space-time foam and then just sort of spontaneously inflated, then that opens up the possibility that somewhere along the line, another little random fluctuation might have spontaneously inflated. There could be another universe. Because separate universes don't really interact, just that seems to be a law of physics, it's impossible for us to even know whether or not they exist. I mean, we could be one of many just kind of floating in space. And that's certainly an intriguing notion in current thinking in cosmology.
Okay. Are we really sure that there are not some conditions in which they do interact? They're kind of strangely, uniquely, and if they do, it certainly would explain a lot of the inexplicable.
Well, I don't know if it explains the inexplicable, but it certainly is an intriguing notion. And it depends, I guess, on the model of the multiverse that you're looking at. In the Hawking model, where you essentially have a baby universe butting off, connected by tiny wormholes. The minute you postulate the existence of a wormhole, then you've got the possibility of a connection. There's a lot of very good physics reasons why wormholes just don't last very long and makes them almost impossible to traverse, for anything material to go through them. But it certainly is an intriguing notion. And
well, that was the whole mode of travel in contact, of course.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, Kip Thorne was a Caltech physicist who came up is a Caltech physicist, who came up with the prototype for the wormhole that was used in Contact, basically by postulating, well, if we had this form of negative energy that could hold it open long enough to get something through. Very, very interesting concept. We have yet to even find any example of negative energy or negative matter anywhere in the universe, but it's certainly an intriguing notion.
Was that one wormhole, or was that a series of wormholes in contact? It seemed like a series.
I think it was just one, but it's hard to tell because they take liberties, of course. I haven't read the book in a very long time. I saw the movie recently, and they did, how you portray something on screen is sometimes very different from how you would do it in a book.
Well, when they did it on screen, it appeared that she would come out of one and sort of look around, and things would be different. Oh, the stars would all be different, and then, boom, she'd be in another one.
Well, that's true. That's true. I had forgotten about that. Certainly, if you can create one wormhole, then you can create more than one. It's just it takes a huge amount of energy.
A lot of coordination.
There's a whole lot of, just really advanced stuff that needs to happen in order to make it happen, but it's also what makes it such great science fiction.
Okay, you have compared universes to the surface tension in soap bubbles?
Oh, I haven't. It's actually a paper that was published last year in Physical Review Letters. The I don't know if you're familiar, and I'm sure you are, with the accelerating universe, the fact that the expansion of our universe is actually speeding up. And that's due to, they believe, something called dark energy, and that's sort of, there's a number that they call the cosmological constant that is essentially a kind of tension pervading the universe that's kind of forcing it to speed up in its expansion. So there's a husband and wife cosmology team who have come up with this sort of theoretical model based on the surface tension in soap bubbles. Bubbles have that spherical shape because the surface tension along them essentially forces them to adopt a shape that has, you know, the minimum surface area possible. And it's somewhere between a sphere and a cube, essentially.
The trouble with soap bubbles is they burst.
Yes, exactly. And we do not want that to happen to our universe.
It's not suggested that it could, is it?
No, it's not, thank goodness. I mean, obviously the analogy is not perfect, but it is very, very interesting, some of the similarities that they've found. They're not saying it's just like our universe. They're saying that we can learn something by conducting these experiments using a particular kind of soap bubble because, I mean, it gets very complicated, but it essentially ties into one of the competing theories for the expansion of the universe.
Okay, well, what this expansion apparently means is that somewhere in the dark future, or pun intended, I guess I had to say, we're going to be entirely alone. In other words, somewhere we're going to be able to look into the night sky and the stars are going to be literally gone.
Yeah, that's a really terrifying thought to me because I've always loved looking at the stars. And essentially, I believe that that's kind of what cosmologists are saying. I mean, you know, if the universe expansion is accelerating, then what's going to happen is things are going to just get farther and farther apart until to the point where the light from the stars will not be able to reach us. It will just have too far to travel, and we will be in darkness. And the universe will become a very cold, dark, lonely place. And I just
What about our nearer neighbors, Mars, the other planets, our own sun?
Uh-huh. Well, chances are, by the time all that happens, the sun, I believe this is well after the lifetime of our sun. So actually, chances are we won't even survive. But when our sun dies, we die. In fact, even before our sun dies, it's basically going to like puff out and engulf us. So we'll probably die in a fiery death, you know, before we ever have a chance to, you know, be all alone in the cosmos.
I spent a day on Friday with Robert Bigelow. He's Bigelow Aerospace. He's already got one private satellite in orbit, getting ready to launch number two.
Oh.
And one of the points he was making, actually traveled to Bigelow Aerospace in Las Vegas, he said, we're going to have to eventually figure a way to get off this planet because one way or the other, it's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're going to die and it's going to keep going. One of the two, we're going to need to be able to colonize Mars and other planets or else.
He's got a point. In fact, there's a physicist at Columbia named Michio Kaku who would take it one step further, who thinks that we need to actually find a different universe.
That's right. I know Michio very well. He says, well, in fact, let's run some of that by you. I'm sure then you've heard his theory about type 1, type 0, 1, 2, and 3, and so forth.
Yes, I have.
Would you generally agree with that?
I'm in no position to argue with someone that smart. but yeah, I kind of do. And I also agree that we're basically type zero or, you know, less than zero at this point in terms of you know, what might be possible. But I actually really enjoyed reading his books, particularly the most recent one, Parallel Worlds. It kind of rehashes some stuff from his earlier book, but he's got some really great stuff there about the possibility of seeding a baby universe, of growing our own baby universe and seeding
it. That's right. That's right.
And I love that. It was actually the basis for a great sci-fi novel by Greg Benford called Cosm.
I loved it as well. Now, what he said, though, that, you know, I really pressed him to the wall. He said we're type zero. We're on the cusp of being type one. But when you really do press him to the wall, he said the odds of going from zero to one, making it, surviving the discovery of element 92 are almost zero.
Yeah, I'd trust his odds on that, which is too bad because I would actually really like, you know, to see some of that, you know, to play around with some of those ideas.
It is too bad.
Yeah.
Now, When you look around the world right now, there's lots of evidence that that seems to be right.
In what sense?
Well, more and more people either getting the bomb or wanting the bomb or working really hard on getting the bomb.
Uh-huh.
Now, eventually, somebody's going to use it.
Yes, that's true.
And I guess that would be, now, that might even explain something else that bothers me, though it might be young in the eyes of some. SETI has been looking for a signal for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, maybe it's true, Jennifer, that societies or worlds, that life is fairly common, and it comes along, and it gets to a certain point, and then destroys itself. And if that is true, then we wouldn't hear from them.
Probably not.
Maybe that's why we have not heard from them.
Well, there's probably a lot of reasons. I'm trying to think. I know I've heard something about this. There's a physicist who basically, I mean, his premise is if there was life anywhere near us, then, you know, the proof would have been that we would have heard from them by now.
Right.
I mean, he basically calculated the odds and the likelihood of it. That doesn't mean that, you know, there aren't, you know, other universes and, you know, maybe, you know, people like or beings like us, you know, in those. But again, we're postulating that there's no possibility of communication or interaction between those. So we would have no way of knowing. We might as well be millions of light years away from them.
Huh. It feels awfully lonely.
I know.
I would
be. The cosmos is a big, cold place.
Yeah. I'd be so happy if we suddenly got any kind of a signal. Anybody, anywhere out there. I wonder how it would change the world, and if it would really change the world if we made contact of some sort.
Well, it's funny because that's obviously been the premise of a number of science fiction movies, and almost never good, with the possible exception of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I'm not sure, but I do know that given human nature and how we react to the unknown and the unfamiliar and what's not, you know, we're rather xenophobic even among our own kind. I shudder to think of how we might react to something that's nothing like us.
I do too. Mostly we shoot first and ask questions later.
Exactly. We react in fear to what's unknown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even governments. In other words, not just individuals. Individuals, of course, do that with the unknown, but so do governments.
Yes,
and
yes.
I for one second, doubt that our government would take a pot shot at something that it thought was in its airspace that ought not be.
Oh, yeah. And I'm quite sure that's happened.
So. Oh, well, you may be referring to something from another nation, or do you think that there have been unknowns from elsewhere?
Oh, I'm sure that what I meant was that accidents like that would happen, I mean, certainly. Sorry.
Okay. There are a lot of things here on Earth that are inexplicable. Certainly science can't take a bite out of them, even though they seem to be really going on. Things like telepathy.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, there are all these experiments that have been going on at Princeton, for example.
Yes, and they just closed the ESP lab there.
How sad is that?
Well, you know, I really kind of admire this guy for sticking to his guns. I think he's like 76 and he's just tired of fighting it.
Yeah, I've got a quote here somewhere. I've actually got the story, but what he basically said was, if they don't believe by now, they're not going, then they never will.
Right, right.
Oh, here it is. If people don't believe us after all the results we've produced, then they never will. And with that, he's closing the doors.
Well, I think he's leaving it to others to kind of follow in on his work. Although, I have to say, you know, their results, we're looking at, you know, two or three parts out of a 10,000 kind of thing. They're statistically not very significant. I mean, I would have liked to have seen a little more solid data in that respect.
Well, at 76 years of age, he deserves to go rest for a while and have fun. All right, Jennifer, hold tight. Jennifer Ouellette is my guest. Promise you, it's going to be a very interesting night. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Here I am. Jennifer Ouellette is my guest. She's written a book called The Physics of the Buffyverse, and we'll get to what the Buffyverse is like, as well as a lot more. We'll be back in a moment. Once again, Jennifer Willett. Jennifer, welcome back.
No, thanks.
All right, so telepathy, telekinesis, all of these interesting things that have been experimented with and looked at, I take it you don't really believe human beings can do them, or do you?
Not in the way we conventionally think of it. I mean, it's a very attractive thought. I mean, it and it makes perfect sense. It seems like it should exist because we communicate, you know, ourselves communicate electrically, brain signals, you know, electrochemical signals and things like that can actually have very positive, you know, or, you know, measurable physical effects on the body. The problem is when you're going, you know, trying to go from brain to brain, it just you'd need a very, very strong signal, and you'd need it at a very, very precisely tuned frequency, and it just would not, you'd need something extra. However, I'm very fond of quoting Arthur C. Clarke. He was basically saying that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, which I think is a wonderful quote. And that actually got me thinking about what it would take to do something. I mean, we communicate through invisible radio waves all the time. And with the current wireless phenomenon, it looks like, you know, it might be possible one day to maybe have something like this, but it would be technologically based. Basically, you would need a transmitter and a receiver in every person and everything, and then you might then be able to have this give and take.
That's not really so far out, is it? In other words, some sort of amplification for your brain waves, and then some sort of transmission and reception capability.
Exactly. In fact, they're already experimenting with basically implants on the motor cortex of the brain. They've done it in monkeys. They've actually worked with it in people who are paralyzed, so they can move cursors on a computer screen with their thoughts. These are all very much in the early prototype stages, and there's a lot of issues, chief among them being biocompatibility, because these things tend to degrade over time, and it can be very life-threatening. Mm-hmm. But it's a really interesting concept. And so I don't believe in telepathy or telekinesis in any kind of magical sense, but I do believe that, you know, we could get to the point where technologically we could achieve something that looks like that. It's just that it would be based in science as opposed to magic.
I wonder if there are going to be a lot of ethical issues involved in that.
Possibly. What did you have in mind? Or what were you thinking?
Well, I don't know. I there's a lot of people out there who are scared to death of implants. And to them, it is the number of the beast. It is the end of life as we know it.
Well, that's, again, fear of the unknown. When barcodes first came out, people freaked. I mean, I remember, I grew up in the 1970s, and everyone was convinced that you know, we would all be required to get a barcode on the forehead or the back of the hand, and that would be the number of the beast. You know,
don't rule it out.
Yeah.
in other words, in your hand, instead of having to have a card, it would be a lot more secure to just sort of wave your hand over the sensor.
Yes, and they are experimenting with RFID tags. You know, implanted sort of things. I mean, it is not all that far out. And so, yes, I can see how that would make some people uncomfortable. Either you're comfortable with the technology, you're not. But eventually, I think people get used to it. We don't think anything about, you know, supermarket barcoding anymore.
No. And I often wonder, you know, when they're sitting there ringing up 120 things that you just bought, and you're not paying, I don't pay attention. I really don't pay attention. I'm sure there are a lot of people who do, but you've got to wonder, are they really getting the price right?
Right. I don't pay attention either.
Yeah.
I kind of, you know, if it's way off, if suddenly you've got a $2,000 grocery bill, but you have no way of knowing otherwise.
Well, right. Okay. Well, let's wander further out again. We are told that the beginning of everything was this great explosion. This giant explosion that emanated from something even smaller, perhaps, than a quark, that has become all that is now, right?
Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty right, yeah.
It sounds right. In other words, what they say.
That is the working theory. But the truth is that, you know, we have this big bang, but physicists are still kind of, you know, toying around with it, trying to figure out, you know, what was there before the big bang. I mean, why did these particular conditions exist that gave rise to the big bang? And we don't actually know that.
Doesn't that violate everything we think we know, in a way?
In what sense?
How could all that is, that so much mass come from something with virtually no mass?
Well, but it came from something with a whole lot of energy. And, I mean, Einstein's E equals MC squared is basically about energy-mass conversion. All of that stuff was basically created, you know, from these primordial, from this big primordial explosion. You had this very hot, dense environment. Surely you're familiar, I'm sure, with the notion of virtual particles.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and basically you had these, you know, matter-antimatter particle pairs popping out of existence. What scientists don't understand is that for some reason, matter won. There was a slight discrepancy. There should have been equal numbers of each, because everything we know about physics is, you know, that it's symmetrical in terms of, you know, matter, antimatter, energy conservation, and all that sort of thing. For some reason, a very slight asymmetry occurred, so that all the antimatter was wiped out, and there was a little bit of antimatter, and that literally did become everything we see around us today. And I agree with you. It is just mind-boggling. That is, in fact, to the best of scientific knowledge, what happened.
Is it indistinguishable from magic?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, it's an actual mechanism. It's something that, you know, we can actually see the remnants in the cosmic microwave background radiation, you know, of these explosions. So we actually do have a record of it, an experimental record of what happened all those billions and billions of years ago. So in that respect, it's not magic. I mean, magic is something that we don't understand, that we think just kind of happens. And I don't think that's the case at all. We might not know the answer, but there's no doubt in my mind that someday we will. And that in turn will raise even more questions, because that's the beauty of science.
Almost every scientist that I have the honor to interview doesn't believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
I call myself an agnostic. I'm a little unusual in that I had a very religious upbringing. I was raised by evangelical Christians. I actually do have a very extensive knowledge of the Bible, and I have a great deal of respect for people who believe, for people who have faith. I don't confuse it with science. To me, those are two very, very different things. And I finally just had, I think, to get to the point where I could be honest with myself and say, you know, this really isn't real to me the way it is, say, for my parents. It is real to them. I believe it's real to them. For me, it just isn't. And I feel that what's more important is that you be honest with where you stand and that you don't disparage people who maybe believe differently from you.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. But with respect to the actual question, the answer is no?
No. There is no proof of it. And I don't have the kind of faith that can go without, you know, at least some shred of evidence. Everything I think that is there can be explained scientifically, you know, that there's an actual natural mechanism. There's really no need for a God. It doesn't mean there isn't one, you know, and we could all be surprised and find that there is one. But in general, I'm not a fan of organized religion or theology, even though I might, you know, acknowledge that there might be a God.
Well, I'm in the same camp as you. I kind of think there might be a God, because somehow or another, it makes sense to me, but that there could be a much larger intelligence than ourselves, that there could be intelligent design. However, a lot collides with it in science. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm kind of an agnostic, but I guess I wish I believed, and I sort of envy the comfort that's given to those who do absolutely have faith. There's a lot of comfort there.
Yes, there is. And I very much agree with you on that. I mean, it's, you know, part of me would like to believe, but if I'm really honest with myself, I have to say that I don't. And that's something that, you know, obviously coming from my background, I had to come very much to terms with.
Well, somebody said that death is a little slice of, or sleep is a little slice of death. And and when you sleep without dreaming, or conscious remembrance of dreaming, it's not so bad. So if death is just kind of like sleep without dreams, wouldn't be all that bad, I guess.
Well, and we wouldn't know the difference. To me, the most frightening thing about death is just not existing, you know, because, you know.
That's right.
Just not, it's impossible for us to conceive of that, because our universe is us. I mean, the world does revolve around us in the respect, in terms of our own psyche.
Okay, is there nothing in your science background that says, well, maybe consciousness, which we don't, certainly we don't fully understand yet, is a bunch of electrons racing around doing their job. And maybe at the moment of physical death, there is some sort of continuation. It's possible.
It is, you know, because, I mean, if we accept that, you know, matter is neither created or destroyed, you know, our bodies may die, but something must continue. And I think that's kind of the root at the idea of, you know, the soul or whatever. I mean, people just have this, it's just impossible for them to conceive of the fact that that animating force doesn't go somewhere. But you're right. I mean, we don't know the first thing about consciousness, really.
When
we can't emulate it in the lab. Best artificial intelligence doesn't even come close.
You're right. And when we go to an island somewhere or the deepest reaches of some continent where nobody's ever been before, we always find the natives worship something. So yeah, there must be something in our brains that demands that we worship something.
I've often wondered about that. There are certainly... I think that we need to understand, and we need an explanation for things, and there is something in human nature that just seems to just want something bigger to take care of it.
Yeah.
You know, that created everything. Certainly, if you look at mythologies from the world over, and this is my English major background talking, you see a lot of the same motifs and themes. You actually do see Christ-like figures pop up over and over again, traveling to the underworld and coming back and things like that. You have the whole voyage of the hero that Joseph Campbell talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it in every single culture. So there clearly does seem to be some very broad, universal human themes. But... again, that's a very, very nebulous area of science. It's really tough to get hard data on that.
What about the Bible? There's so much in there.
There is.
These miracles that occurred. And then so much documentation found hither and yon to seem to back it up. It's obvious something happened.
Yeah, I find the Bible very fascinating. When I was a kid, I loved reading it. The stories are fantastic. And the poetry is gorgeous. As a literary work, it's stunning. The problem, I think, is that, you know, these are very, very old texts. By the time all these stories were written down, they'd been passed orally for, you know, hundreds of years, you know, if not longer. And, you know, we all know that things get lost in the translation. So there might be some element of truth in these things, but whether they were actual miracles, I'm not so sure. I personally would love to see a neurological explanation for glossolalia, for speaking in tongues.
Uh-huh. So would I.
I know scientists are working on trying to understand what is happening in the brain at that time. I know when I was growing up, I saw it all the time. I was never capable of it. Some people do seem to be able to do this, and I would like to know what's going on in their brains that enables them to do that.
Is there any science looking at that?
There is. It seems to be a neurochemical process. They've actually done brain images of people while they were speaking in tongues to try and figure out what's going on. I haven't read up on those studies, so I can't speak to what they found. I don't think they were particularly conclusive, but they did have some interesting ideas floating about. Planning a blog post on it at some point in the future, because I find it very, very interesting.
If you were given the option, Jennifer, to continue to exist, but inside a processor, as opposed to inside a body, would you take that option over death?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I would. I like the body. I like food. You know, I like sex. I like all these various things that make us, you know, that tie us uniquely to this earth. There was actually an X-Files episode that was written by William Gibson where, you know, a young couple did just that. They basically uploaded their consciousness into a computer, you know, to kind of live forever, be united forever in that. I don't know. I think that one of the beautiful things of being human is that we do have this, you know, animal higher nature, you know, this mind and body kind of connection going. And I would really be loath to lose that.
Mm-hmm. Very well explained. Well, I'm not sure that we're all that far from it. The day may come when, you know, with these new computers and all the rest of it, one day we may be able to virtually upload ourselves. And I wonder if everything would go, if our consciousness would, for example, go. I mean, we can copy a computer program. and we get a precise copy. So wouldn't there come a time when we could virtually copy the brain?
Well, we know so little about the brain that not in my lifetime would be my guess, although who knows the way computer technology is advancing. But that, you know, that would, you know, raise a very important issue. I mean, we talk in genetics about, you know, the dangers of cloning, and, you know, we've managed to clone sheep and all these various things. We haven't yet managed to clone a human, but certainly people
are
worried about that. Pardon?
Are you sure?
Well, I mean, no, but I haven't heard any reports on it, and I'm going to go with what's in the literature.
Well, if they did it, I have this feeling they might not report it for all kinds of good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can clone animals, I don't think it's that much of a reach to clone a human. Is it really, technologically?
Well, I can't. I'm not a geneticist. I mean, probably not. I would guess that, you know, there's probably, you know, some minor tweaking that has to be done. But I also think that there's a real barrier, you know, that some part of us doesn't want to go there. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I personally would not want to see my consciousness cloned. I like my consciousness to be individual.
I'm not sure your consciousness would be cloned.
Right.
I think there would be a consciousness in the new you, but it would be a separate consciousness.
Interesting.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, we know so little about it. You know, I haven't read enough Daniel C. Dennett to really know.
We are getting ready, I think, in the world now to fire up a particle accelerator, right?
Yes, the Large Hadron Collider.
Mm-hmm. What do you think will happen?
Well, I actually, you know, I'm not sure they're going to find evidence for extra dimensions and some of the more exotic things they're looking for, but I think there's a very good chance we'll see evidence for the Higgs boson, which is what essentially gives atoms mass, gives things their mass, why we weigh so much, essentially. As opposed, you know, yes, we eat a lot of cheeseburgers, but why we have any mass at all basically comes from the Higgs boson. Beyond that, it'll be very interesting to see what happens if they get to higher and higher energies. And certainly they actually just announced plans for the next generation linear collider, which is intended as kind of a complement to the LHC.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, yeah. An international group, I think, in Beijing just released a report. It's going to be huge. It's going to be expensive. And it'll kind of, you know, it's intended scientifically to complement what's going to happen at the LHC. But, you know, ideally I'd like to see, you know, some evidence pro or con for something like, say, string theory, which has been really criticized heavily in recent years for not having any experimental evidence to back it up. I think that I heard Brian Greene speak, and he was basically saying, look, even if we're wrong, we'd like to know we're wrong. We'd like to test it and have evidence for or against. So if I had a wish list for what would come out of the LHC and subsequently the ILC, it would be something like that. I would like to, you know, at least get some evidence one way or the other whether we're on the right track.
Do you believe that string theories, when they fire these up, let me rephrase that. Do you think that careers will fall or rise based on what happens with the accelerators?
I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think that the string theory backlash has already begun in earnest, but I don't think someone's career is going to be ruined. I mean, science progresses in a sense. I mean, failure is just as much a part of that progress as success is. You have to be able to take these kinds of risks and put these ideas out there. The nature of science is to hypothesize and then basically, you know, to test it and see, you know, whether or not it's true. I mean, scientists actually can be kind of irritated in that respect because you say an idea and then they immediately start poking holes in it. But
yes,
that's essentially how they test things, and that's how science advances.
Speaking of holes, black holes, should we create a black hole? Is that a bad idea?
Well, if you're talking about the LHC, the kinds of black holes that they think might appear would be really, really tiny. So tiny that they would almost evaporate almost instantly.
One hopes.
Pardon?
One hopes.
Actually, they're pretty sure.
Pretty sure. Okay. On that note, hold tight. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell.